You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello everyone, welcome to The Orthodox Nationalist. I am Matthew Raphael Johnson, and this is being recorded for Radio Albion over Memorial Day weekend 2024. And today I want to talk about something that I've yet to discuss. I mean, we've talked about the White Army, we've talked about the Civil War in Russia and just how significant it is, but I want to talk about something more specific, the start of that war, the Ice March of 1918, which means we're going to be talking about General Kornilov, as well as the volunteer army which he created, the Kuban and Don Cossacks, because it's in these regions to the far south of Russia that this took place. So the Bolsheviks seized power in November of 1917, October in the old calendar. And those who opposed this new government gravitated, so to speak, to the outer fringes of the old empire, especially in those areas that were under the control of the German army. Remember, this is still in the latter stages of the First World War. Among the Don Cossacks, whose headquarters, Novocherkassk near Rostov, the Cossack host elected General Alexei Kalinin to the position of Ataman there, Hetman elsewhere, in July of 1917. But by the end of that year, not long after the Reds took over in at least in the big cities of Central Russia, the Don Cossack Assembly declared its independence, and so Novocherkassk became a center for those opposed to the Red takeover, and that's where the Volunteer Army was initially headquartered. I really shouldn't say, you know, Lavr Kornilov took over, but it actually began with General Mikhail Alexeyev. So the Cossacks and the Whites were two different movements. Those of you who are subscribed to my Patreon account have read a lengthy and very original article on the peasant wars at the end of the Civil War. This is at the start of it. And you note that the Cossack forces on the one hand and the White Army on the other sometimes didn't agree. As things got worse and worse, however, they had no choice. The Cossacks aimed for two things in particular, and they really ended up being one thing. That was the defeat of the Reds on the one hand, militarily, and their own autonomy within Russia on the other. But right after the takeover, under Kalinin, the Cossacks and the Whites, the Volunteer Army had maybe 500 men under it. There's another distinction you have to make, and that's between the Bolshevik forces under local party committees and the Bolshevik forces under Trotsky or Lenin. Those can be and sometimes functioned as two separate things. Centralized control was eventually established, but the local Bolshevik committee in Rostov was captured and driven out of that city at the very end of 1917, but then centralized. The better organized Bolshevik forces began to advance the beginning in the winter of early 1918, advancing from the north, and they captured Taganrog, the Sea of Azov, on the beginning of February 1918. But by this point, the Red Bolshevik policies were increasingly well known. So now Kornilov had about 4,000 men at Rostov, and he judged it, given the numerical superiority the Reds had, that he was not going to defend this major city. So the Ice March came about as the Volunteer Army retreated deeper into the Kuban in the hopes of attracting more support from the Cossacks, and hence their defeat of the Red Army later on. So in the Don River region, as early as November of 1917, that's where Alexeyev organized the Volunteer Army. And that December, remember, World War I practically had another year to go, not quite, but they had two missions. The first was to resist, and this is what they said, the Germano-Bolshevik attack, because back then, despite the fact that the German government through banks in New York were financing the Bolsheviks, the German army will soon turn on them for very obvious reasons. But to resist that attack in the south and southeast of Russia, defending along with the Cossacks the independence of those regions that gave the whites shelter. And they called this the last stronghold of Russian independence, and to quote them, the last hope for the restoration of a free Great Russia. That was the first thing. The second thing is the restoration of the destroyed Russian statehood. And what they understood a new statehood to mean was to bring all Eastern Slavs under a new constituent assembly, before the decision of which all classes, parties, and individual groups of the population must bow. I've stated before, there's some problems with these two aims. Pretty soon, the resistance, at least in certain places, in parts of Ukraine, against the Reds actually came from the German army as World War I came to a close, whatever it is, 10 months later. The Cossacks slowly and then increasingly began to realize what they were up against. And beyond that, a united Great Russia, which included Ukraine, which almost destroyed their chances of winning in the Southwest, and this notion of a constituent assembly, which, according to some of the white commanders anyway, would include the Bolshevik Party, etc., despite the fact that they would never allow an election with the whites. So, pretty soon, and it doesn't take a genius to figure out that the Volunteer Army, a few thousand men by this point were being protected in the Don region of the Don River, the Don Cossacks, and they were accused, of course, of counter-revolution. And most Russians at this point, and there are some exceptions, experienced the persecution, at least from the big cities, of the armed Bolshevik movement. Now, Red propaganda, as I've said 1,000 times before, was much better than white propaganda. The Reds had an ideological advantage. They were a unified, and I know a lot of the ideology that they promoted at the time was a lie, land to peasants and that kind of thing, which they would never allow. Worker control of industry, which they would never allow. So by the beginning January, the beginning of 1918, you did have some peasant unions having been won over by Red propaganda. It didn't take long for them to realize how wrong they are, but the propaganda machine, aided by the West, was very successful. Now, the Don government, that is to say the Cossack government, invited General Alexeyev so that he could personally reassure certain peasant, very large peasant communal unions about the white goals, which were always very vague. Peasants eventually, and again, I've talked about the peasant uprisings throughout the Civil War and immediately after, the so-called Green Movement, which is a myth of academia, but this particular meeting with General Alexeyev was attended by all Cossack members, the local Cossack government, and the majority of representatives from the peasant unions. These peasant unions will eventually, I think when it was too late, rise against the Reds. But by this time, there was a more or less internal exile government, and that they have been introduced to it, and they wanted to reconcile with the peasantry. But given the news that the peasants were getting from elsewhere, it didn't take long for them to come around. So one of the regional governments, there was a peasant congress who, you know, the peasant congresses were generally literate and very politicized. They ordered a comprehensive review of the organization, the activities, and the tasks of the volunteer army. And then they organized in late the fall of 1917, the Union for the Salvation of Russia, which was organized in Moscow from representatives of the, up until that point, fairly liberal cadet party. And General Alexeyev said that he was entrusted with this task of saving Russia from the internationalist Reds, and that's why he came to the Don. As this is going on, refugees from other parts of Russia began to flow, and they brought news as to exactly what was happening. So, starting in February of 1918, we have this epic, this heroic mission. And it began probably on the 9th of 1918 that became a future, it became a symbol of the future, not just the whites in the Civil War, but Russia even in exile. The ice campaign of General Kornilov. And February 9th really was the birthday of the White Army and the revival of either old Russia or Russia, just generally speaking. And now there was another ice campaign later in Siberia. We're talking about something very different. We're talking about the foundation of the Volunteer Army after the Red takeover and this alliance with the Cossacks starting in early the freezing winter of 1918. And this was the, we'll talk here in a minute, the heroism and the despair, as well as the nobility, that this fairly small army will display. Now, the Bolsheviks, as a few writers have mentioned, have tried to overlay that symbol, the 9th of February, which was the birth of the White Army, with the creation of the Red Army. Almost at the same moment. And that's, you know, largely nonsense. But around that time, Commander Pavel Diabenko, his sailors, who didn't do very much, fled from the Germans to the first sign of trouble. They boarded a train and went 750 miles south to Thamara. But you still had a white prejudice against the Germans. But by the end of the war, by the end of 1918, the Germans clearly wanted nothing to do with the Bolsheviks, despite their past support that the government gave via Wall Street. The resistance didn't come, well, at least against Germany, as the war came to an end, had nothing to do. The Red Guard had nothing to do with it. The remnants of the old Russian army did not succumb to you know, Kerensky's corruption. So there was some confusion as to what role the Germans played. And in fact, a historian's job here is so difficult because of the confusion that was found everywhere. So I guess the place to start is the Bolshevik agreement with the Germans, where the sealed carriage was dispatched with Lenin and his accomplices through Germany and into Russia. The Reds and the Western Allies, though, were anything but enemies. They used whatever support they could get. And the only reason that the Bolsheviks ever occasionally received the symbolic reproof from the Allies was only, well, in Woodrow Wilson's mind, only if they acted like the Tsars acted, which he said several times. We all know Colonel House, etc. But the only reproof that they really got systematically was if they either would or could not reopen the front against Germany as the war ground down. And that's what led to the Allied intervention. You know, I've made a big deal about this in the past, that no intervention of the Entente ever had anything to do with the defeat of the Bolsheviks. Their role, at least in the northern part of the country, was to capture and secure the German ammunition stores. But the Bolsheviks were afraid of something completely different, and that was the popular resistance to their tactics. And they were already gathering troops from deserters, idlers, and criminal elements released from prison. Anyone who could be attracted by the propaganda of plunder, as a few writers have stated, that the Reds were so skilled at disseminating. The Bolsheviks never had to worry about money or supplies, since both from Germany, up until a certain point anyway, and the Allies, both sides of the Great War, were funding them. But the whites, and what we're going to talk about here right now, in the southern part of the country, were desperate from beginning to end. And that's why you have these heroic actions like the Ice March, which was the birth of the White Army and, you know, was the first phase in their defeat by 1920-1921. So when Dybenko's sailors were fleeing the Germans via train, these guys were already traveling south to the Don River area, where the same place where a popular uprising would begin. The uprising against the Bolsheviks really didn't occur until roughly a year later, really in 1919, but in 1918, the population as a whole, especially outside of the central regions, didn't understand the nature of Trotsky's agenda quite yet. I mentioned Ataman Kalidin. He issued a call to resist the Reds, and all of 150 men responded. There was a 10,000-strong Bolshevik army traveling by rail from Moscow to face them. These young men, mostly high school students, some military cadets, they understood what was happening around them, but the older generation didn't. They were war-weary. They were completely exhausted. They had this overwhelming aboulia or malaise that came from World War I. And this is why Kalidin eventually shot himself, because of what he was facing and the fact that very few initially responded to his call. Now, that would change later on. But he committed suicide, as far as I know, for, among other things, that was one of the big reasons. It was a humiliation for him. And that's the conditions under which Kornilov made the decision to leave the major city of Rostov without a fight. Preserving the backbone of his force, moved to Yekaterindar, where the government of Colonel Viktor Pokrovsky operated. And in the Kuban, it was possible to gather strength, to regroup his forces, and then strike at the Bolsheviks, despite being few in number at the time. For the moment, it was important to save what still couldn't be saved and then marshal his resources for later. So this ice campaign is this very story. The night of February 22nd of 1918, by order of Kornilov, the Volunteer Army, which had at the time exactly 3,683 men, left the city of Rostov towards the Don Steppe. And it also just so happened that a significant convoy of civilians that were fleeing the Bolsheviks too retreated with this detachment, which just added another layer of complexity. And let me quote General Anton Denikin, who wrote on this issue. He said, "As long as there is life, as long as there is strength, not everything is lost. Those who have not yet woken up will see the light flickering faintly. They will hear a voice calling for a fight." This was the whole deep meaning of the first Kuban campaign. You should not approach with cold argumentation of politics and strategy, a phenomenon in which everything is in the realm of spirit and a feat being performed. The Volunteer Army walked across the free steppe to the Don and Kuban, small in number, tattered, hunted, surrounded, as a symbol of persecuted Russia and Russian statehood. In the entire vast expanse of the country, there was only one place left where the tricolor national flag openly fluttered, and this was in Kornilov's headquarters. The whites barely had a chance even at the time. The Ice March was this retreat from Rostov to the steppe. He stopped and regrouped in the village of Oginskaya, and that's when he organized what would be the first Volunteer Army, when Denikin mentions the first Kuban campaign, we're talking about the Ice March. It's one and the same thing. He brought together smaller detachments that had scattered after the temporary fall of the Don Cossack government, and the officer detachment of General Sergei Markov approached, making its way through Batask, which was occupied by the Bolsheviks, and everything was a matter of crisis and escape. And then Cossack detachments joined. Many of the Cossacks had been neutral, but once they learned what was really happening, they began to flee en masse from Rostov to Novochokhmelnytskyi to the White Armies after the start of the Red Terror. There were only 8 of the larger 3-inch guns, with a very insignificant supply of ammunition available to them at this point. Of course, the Reds never wanted for anything. Now, the numbers, and this is always a matter of debate, but the numbers of the Volunteer Army varied from 300 in the beginning to something like 6,000 at the end. Now, the detachment at this village, the first grouping, consisted of, it seems, an excessive number of generals. There were 36, 242 staff officers, 190 colonels, 460 captains, and 900 lieutenants, which seems an awful lot of officers. You had 668 warrant officers. The enlisted force was just over 1,000, including 427 cadets, 630 just plain old soldiers, 364 NCOs, and 235 privates, and that included 66 Czechs and Rusyns from Galicia, who had been prisoners of war as they had been in the Austrian army. To their advantage, they had 21 doctors and 122 nurses. So because this was so top-heavy with officers, you had entire units made entirely of officers of various ranks. And it's something that Kornilov used to a great effect. Generals Alexander Lukomsky and Sergei Voronzhin said that the masses of soldiers were accumulating in the Kuban region, and they were returning home from the Transcaucasian front. The soldiers were detained initially by the Bolsheviks, who lied to them, saying that if you want to go home, if you want to go back to Central Russia, it was blocked by the Whites, and therefore to get home, you had to fight and defeat them. And the Reds were very good at this kind of, you know, lying this propaganda. So February 23rd, the White Army entered that small village for the rendezvous with Cossack Ataman Popov on the 26th. Popov, however, elected to stay within the Don region while the Volunteer Army headed south towards Yekaterindor and Kuban. So, February 21st, 1918, the column of the Volunteer Army reached the village of Lezhanki on the border of the Stavropol province in Crimea and very close to the region of the Don Cossacks. Now, on their trip south, for the most part, the Volunteer Army was peaceful, and they were treated pretty warmly by every village that they came across. But the minute they crossed the border into Stavropol, the Whites immediately came under attack from the Reds at Lezhanki. And that's where a fairly substantial local detachment was stationed, but the fight was brief. After the first shots, Kornilov ordered an attack on the village, throwing one of his shock regiments into the attack against really what were incompetent Bolshevik positions. This was not a central military district whatsoever. The Red Guards, you know, they were accustomed to fighting unarmed peasants for the most part, and they will be doing that from there on in, though they'll be armed as time goes on. But they threw their weapons away when they came across actual regular soldiers, screaming and yelling in Yiddish to each other. So the Whites, in that small battle, lost 3 men, but the Reds lost over 250, including, or I should say not including, the taking of 300 Red prisoners. Denikin said in his book, and a few others have noticed since then, that the desecration of the village church in that place, that made a painful impression on them. Denikin said its walls, meaning the church walls, were covered with vile inscriptions, icons were painted over, the altar was turned into a latrine, and they used the sacred vessels for this. And this had an impact on everyone. And it became very clear that this was a very different kind of a movement that they're facing, a very Judaic one. The whites were always outnumbered. But things like this church, it maintained a certain level of mission. It gave them a certain mission that came out of their outrage. But replacing their losses was impossible, which was not the case with the Reds. And the biggest problem that this ICE march had was that so many of them were wounded, and that caravan just stretched out longer and longer. But regardless of these handicaps, they racked up an impressive line of victories on this ICE march. Let me quote again Alexander Trushnovich, who wrote, and I have the 2004 edition of his book on the subject. He said, "The ICE march will serve as proof of the primacy of spirit. In all 33 battles of this first campaign, there was no case where the number of Bolshevik forces did not exceed 6 to 10 times the number of volunteers. Small numbers and the impossibility of retreat, which would be tantamount to death, developed among the volunteers and created their own tactics. It was based on the conviction that given the numerical superiority of the enemy and the scarcity of one's own ammunition, it was necessary to attack and only to attack. This truth, undeniable in a war of maneuvering, entered the flesh and blood of the White Army volunteers. They were always advancing. In addition, their tactics always included striking the enemy's flanks. The battle began with a frontal attack by one or two infantry units, and the infantry advanced in a very thin line, lying down from time to time to give the machine guns a chance to work. It was impossible to cover the entire enemy front, because then the intervals between fighters would reach 50 or even 100 steps. The white artillery hit only important targets, spending only a few shells at a time to support the infantry in exceptional cases. When the infantry rose to attack the enemy, there could be no stopping. No matter how numerically superior the enemy was, they were unable to withstand the white forces." Now, I quote that to give some authority to the notion that the local party committees really just used untrained men, the worst of the worst. There's a reason that whether it be the French Revolution or the Bolshevik Revolution, they emptied the prisons. So at the beginning of March, Kornilov's army reached the village of Korenovskaya. For the preceding week, the campaign was almost constant. The trek was almost constant warfare. The Reds had a capable commander, Rudolf Sievers, who used massed infantry, kind of like the Chinese in Korea. But the Bolsheviks were not capable of any real concerted defense. These were not high-quality men. The volunteers seemed to operate with almost total freedom. The White Guards at Korenovskaya Station, train station, they were waiting for the 14,000-strong army of Ivan Sorokin. Now, that's a Red unit. Sorokin was a Kuban Cossack at one point, who, for reasons strictly his own, went over to serve the Bolsheviks. Sorokin sent some cavalry units to attack from the rear, but they were stopped by white machine gun nests. It really didn't matter, because regardless of their numbers, they weren't anywhere near the quality of the whites, who were actually regular forces. Kornilov personally went on some of these attacks, the officer-manned attacks on the village, and in a short time, the Reds would run away, showing the level of infantry that they had. So Sorokin, yeah, he had large numbers, but his forces were not entirely, they were not regular forces, many of them being simple criminals released from prison. The whites took a lot of prisoners, and he learned from them that the communists had taken the important town of Yekaterindar on March 1st. The government of Colonel Pokrovsky fled into the Circassian villages while the city was given over to communists for plunder. And, of course, they behaved very badly, as you might imagine. In Yekaterindar, there were robberies, executions of anyone accused, suspected of sympathizing with the whites, the volunteers. So the result of this, and hearing all of these stories, Kornilov decided to go to the mountain villages to find these men in their hiding places, the defeated whites. So Sorokin, learning about the abandonment of that village they were in, threw his forces into the pursuit. Kornilov figured out Sorokin's plan, for an attack across the river. So the White Sea is the only bridge before the battle began. They fought through every village, clearing them of the red infestation, and of course taking whatever supplies they can get their hands on. The Bolsheviks realized that stopping Kornilov was going to be far more difficult than they had realized, and what else is new for them, they decided to start using scorched earth tactics, burning villages and homes along their route of retreat. And that's a grim foreshadowing of their policies much later on. So we're still in early March. The volunteers entered the Kuban region roughly March 9th. And at Berezinskaya on March 14th, another battle, 4 days. And the White Army, by the 17th of March, the small group finally took a few villages in the area. And there's actually, in Korenovskaya, as I mentioned, there was a large cache of military supplies there. The 28th, you had the most bitter battle fought against the Bolsheviks, in which a number of volunteer officers froze to death crossing a small icy river. And that's one of the things that gave the campaign its name. So finally, the volunteer army found Viktor Pokrovsky's Kuban army, as I mentioned, who had recently fled the city, and absorbed them into their own forces. So given all of this, the White Army, the volunteer army, was growing in number. They even had an old Junker battalion. They even advanced with empty rifles, with bayonets, and counting on and succeeding where the Reds were simply wavered and ran. Now, there were plenty of Circassians who had already experienced the Red Terror. Now, these are mostly Muslims. In the Circassian village of Gabukai, the Reds slaughtered around 320 men. In Asokolai, another village, they murdered 305. And they went on and on and on. So as this was occurring, roughly early March, late February of 1918, the Circassian army was slowly being raised to support Kornilov. And the most famous commander was General Islam Girey Ulgay, who called for revenge against these attacks, Muslim, of course. And they asked to be accepted to the White Army, and Islam Girey became a major asset. So things are looking up. At the village of Novodmitrievskaya, Markov's regiment went on the attack. And he went on the attack really before reinforcements arrived, such as they were. And I'm going to quote Denikin here, because once Kornilov was killed, he took over. And he said, "The regiment rushed with great abandon. They overturned the line of defense and drove through the village where the main Red forces, not expecting such an attack, were resting at home. Kornilov arrived with his forces, and when they entered the main village square, the Bolshevik command jumped out of the windows and other doors." So clearly this was a local party committee in a relatively small village here who had zero military experience. It doesn't matter how many there were. They were not expecting this White attack. They weren't expecting the level of discipline that the volunteers showed, despite the fact that the Whites really didn't have the ammunition for this. They used their reputation. It's one of the things that makes the Ice March so important, so epic, so to speak. So the Kuban Cossacks, though, by the middle of March, began their activities more and more intensely. And Kornilov began to mix some of their units with his own. And he created three brigades under Generals Markov, Bogdanovsky, and Erdely. And so by the 24th, the volunteer army attacked yet another village with a garrison of 5,000 communists, with more warehouses containing critical supplies. This is how they replenish themselves, not just on the Ice March, but the White Army in general, especially in the South, what we're talking about here, in the freezing South, winter of 1918. The officer regiment attacked Gorgi Afipskaya, the name of this particular village, taking the station, and most importantly, the main supplies, which comprised about 700 boxes of shells and cartridges. That very same day, once the Reds were driven out, the military council met, the losses were officially announced, and it was discovered that fewer than 300 men were left in their irregular units, and even fewer in their officers' guard. making matters more difficult, they had to deal with 1,200 wounded. And again, part of the reason that makes the Ice March what it is, they, at least under Kornilov, refused to abandon any of them. Now, the Kuban army, the Cossack army, wanted to maintain an independent fighting force by the end of March. And there was an official union agreement here, and the military formations of the Kuban regional government, they had over 2,000 cavalry, was brought into Kornilov's army, which he desperately needed. And the Kuban Cossacks, with their own government, pledged to assist to replenish and supply the volunteer army whenever possible. Now, some claim that there were 3,100 men in the Kuban detachment and 2,700 in the volunteer army. But their string of victories, which were impressive and really against all odds, continuously replenished their number. By the end of March, they had about 6,000 men. Again, this is because of the Muslims, the Cossacks, Pokrovsky's men that they went and found, etc. And the Reds, of course, were not expecting anything like this because their policies were barely being put into motion. But the irregular Reds were worse than the regular Reds, especially down here, especially in the deeply rural areas, who they hated in general. So three brigades of two regiments each were formed, and the number of guns actually came to be about 14, which was a big deal for them. The officer regiment and the Junker battalion was merged, and the 5th and 6th companies had made up the 2nd battalion. In total, that regiment had 800 men and 12 machine guns. Again, a big deal for them. A company of cadets from the local Konstantinovsky military school entered into the Kornilov Shock Regiment, and they had actually had fought together in Kiev before, and so there were about 1,000 total, and the 1st Cavalry Regiment, the Czechoslovak Battalion, and the Circassian Cavalry Regiment maintained separate units, but they were still highly motivated ones. So this is a patchwork, obviously, of a bunch of different units, each with its own agenda, but because Kornilov and Denikin later were charismatic men, they were able to forge some kind of a functional army out of it, which is something else that the Reds did not expect anyone to be able to do. So Novodmitrievskaya, by the 22nd of March, became their headquarters so they can gather their forces, continue to attract more men, and then eventually capture the capital of the whole Kuban region. Antonov was another commander of the Reds, constantly attacking. So by 2 days later, 24th of March, the volunteers attacked another major village that had supplies in it. The troops were late. They were supposed to be at night. It wasn't. It turned out to be a battle in daylight. The Red forces used armored trains for the first time, heavy artillery. But only by evening, thanks to the encircling movement of the irregulars, because the volunteers had irregulars too, you know, they reminded you a little bit of J.E.B. Stuart in the Civil War. They were regular cavalry, of course, regular men. They were soldiers. I don't mean irregular in that sense, but they were highly mobile and fast moving. And that's when they captured the station from the enemy, who very quickly began to retreat. And the Markovites even managed to knock out one of their armored trains. And this is how they were constantly replenishing their ammunition stores. They didn't have to shoot one or two shells at a time from their bigger guns. And what the plan was to assault Yekaterindar, which I guess formally and informally was the capital of the Kuban region. And so the Kuban River was crossed about either 10 miles away from their destination. They stormed the village there. The Southeastern Red Army, under the command of Antonov and Sorokin, had about 20,000 men. There's a Soviet historian named Kukurin who said that the strength of the defending Red Guards were about 18,000, a few armored vehicles, and maybe 12 guns. In other words, they outnumbered the volunteers by, what, three times at least. But the Whites were gaining new adherents practically by the hour. And that was because the behavior of the Red forces, irregular and otherwise, local and otherwise, became harsher and harsher. And the more they panicked and the more they were defeated, the more that the population turned on them, the more evil they became. So at the end of the month, 1918, into March, the Volunteer Army launched an attack on Ekaterinodar, and it stretched for 3 days. They celebrated a little too soon. They had already nominated Denikin as Governor General, but there was, for the first time, I think, a strong resistance from the Red Defenders. The Volunteers only captured the outskirts of the city, the artillery barracks, I think, and they suffered far more losses than they could ever replace, and they couldn't advance any further. The shells did run out, and even local Cossacks eventually fled. And as they were preparing their final attack into the city scheduled for the 1st of April, General Kornilov was killed. Some people say it was a random shell or a random grenade, but it probably was done on purpose. The headquarters where he was a farm in the middle of nowhere. That's where the headquarters was, and messengers and officers were constantly going, arriving and leaving, and so it gave the Reds a certain target. And so Kornilov was killed. And that was a ginormous blow, as you can figure, to the Volunteer forces. And only a couple of battalions of the Volunteer Army was able to penetrate the city that night. It wasn't supported by other units, and it had to retreat. It only had about 300 men under arms, 2 machine guns, and General Denikin took command of these forces under the worst possible conditions, because now they were completely encircled by the Bolsheviks. Most people will say that this assault on Ekaterinodar was ill-conceived. 400 whites were killed, including a whole bunch of newer Kuban Cossack recruits. Denikin ordered a stop to the assault and retreated. It was an extremely difficult retreat. They were successful. They made it impossible to track them, maneuvering between railway lines. And the local Kuban residents began to join the Volunteer Army. Because the minute the Reds won something, they treated the population very harshly. In many cases, especially in the irregular units, the more local Red military units, they weren't exactly trying to convince anyone. They had excellent propaganda. But given the nature of their infantry, their hearts and minds were not really on the agenda. Denikin actually left the most severely wounded, out of thousands, of course, but with a staff of doctors and nurses to assist them at a few villages in the area, Ilinskaya, a few others. But Denikin had to face the fact that the Volunteer Army, the nucleus of the White Army, as he called it, a military guard for a convoy of wounded. There was one wounded for every healthy man, and the fight seemed already lost after that ill-conceived assault. So, obviously, the death of Kornilov decided that particular battle. And the impression it made on the army, psychologically, was tremendous. And again, this is how Denikin described the mood of the army that very day, or in April 1st onward. He said, "The impression is shocking. People were crying bitterly, talking among themselves in whispers, as if the controller of their thoughts was invisibly present among them. Everything was concentrated like a focal point, the idea of struggle, faith in victory, hope for salvation. And when it was gone, fear and painful doubt began. We were annoyed by rumors, each more alarming than the next, about new Bolshevik forces surrounding the army on all sides, about the inevitability of captivity and death, the end of everything." So, at this stage, it was despair was taking over. But of course, what were their options here? They knew what would happen to them. Now, it just so happens that very late March, early April, the assault on Ekaterinodar coincided with the height of German successes on the Western Front. March 21st, I think it was, the Germans broke through the English front in Picardy. April 9th, they struck another one in Flanders. The Anglo-French front was wavering. They were constantly transferring German divisions from Russia to France, but the Germans still continued with very high morale their offensive in Ukraine, and they occupied Kharkov on the 10th. The Austrians reached the lower Dnieper. And this was met with mixed feelings, depending on what you thought the Austro-Germans were doing. No one believed, really, after a while, that the Germans were going to be supporting the Reds, not under these conditions. There were Ukrainian Soviet armies transferred from the Don, but that did not stop the rapid advance of the Austro-Germans, both Austrian and German units. And when I say Austrian, I mean throughout the empire. Initially, the Germans weren't going to advance beyond Kharkov, but the dependence of the Ukrainian railways on Donetsk and the coal from there forced them to move even farther east. Needless to say, this was a fortuitous development. The German colony, on April 2nd, the German colony of Gindau, the remnants of the White Army were again surrounded, but they managed to break out in a brutal night attack. By now, their convoy had 3,000 wounded. So the Bolshevik newspapers were going on and on about the defeat and liquidation of the white gangs scattered throughout the North Caucasus. The volunteer army, of course, broke away from the enemy. They were able to strengthen themselves and reach the borders of the Don. So by the spring, beginning of May, the army had made it back to the border of the Don Cossack region. Now, it's easy to forget about the Cossack situation at the time because they were absolutely essential to the white forces in the south. General Popov, the so-called, what they call the marching hetman, the marching ataman, someone given absolute powers, elected, given absolute powers only in combat, did come to an agreement, as we already said, with the volunteer army to coordinate their action. The Cossacks initially, as I said, were neutral, sort of, but only with the practical acquaintance with the Red pogroms, the predatory mood of these gangs, especially at the local level. And these gangs were prepared by Soviet propaganda, promising them the riches of the Don. They made it out to be this extraordinary land of Oz. And so the Red Guards attacked the Cossack farms and stores, endless robbery and executions, etc. These atrocities of the Reds in the Don region pushed the overwhelming majority of the Cossacks, a handful of them, once deceived by Soviet propaganda, into backing the Whites. And this is what's called the awakening of the Don and the Kuban Cossack regions. So, we're talking about, for the most part, irregular Red infantry. Large numbers, very poor in training and discipline. And because of that, because of their reliance on criminals and these elements, they didn't just shoot prisoners. They shot their wives and children, too. And elements of the Popov army returning to the volunteer units were telling them what was going on. And it was always an unequal struggle. The Bolsheviks managed to incite people against the so-called cadets, that's what the people resisting the Bolsheviks in this early period were called. The peasantry of the southeastern part of the Don, where Popov's headquarters were located, the peasants had been told by the Reds that the Whites were doing exactly what the Reds were actually doing. Very well-funded propaganda machine was telling them how evil the Whites were, and a lot of that propaganda is still in history books in the Anglo-American world today. But clearly it was just Red projection. Even at the end of February 1918, General Popov, as we already mentioned earlier than this, amongst the Cossacks and the peasants, were able to verify the falsity of that propaganda to these peasant unions. And that will eventually lead to peasant rebellions against the Reds as time goes on. Unfortunately, many of them too late. But General Popov began the approach to the center of the region, and he had to deal with peasants who may or may not have been brainwashed with that kind of Red propaganda. But the Cossacks as a whole, again, practical acquaintance with the Reds in the villages closest to Novocherkassk became so acute their dissatisfaction with what the Reds were doing, that by the middle of March, the Cossacks ordered, organized another Congress, the Cherkasy district, 25 miles from their capital. And that was their protest conference against what Bolshevism really was. The essence of what the Red takeover meant for them and the peasants, which were, again, different from the Cossacks. Cossacks were free men. Peasants had a different status. And sometimes they agreed, sometimes they didn't. But the Bolshevik invaders were clearly hostile to the Cossacks. And it wasn't as if there was any political agenda. At least initially, the propaganda said one thing, but the robberies and the ruin of the Cossack economy was something else altogether. March 18th, the village of Suvorovskaya was the first to rebel. And a week later, General Popov was already being told about the uprising throughout the Don. And the news caused him to make his final decision to march there. The nearest villages had already asked him to help and had already developed their own volunteer forces. So the Cossacks, even without this, rebelled on their own initiative against Soviet power, and that's when they went to the volunteer forces for help. And this is how the White Army's losses were replenished over time. And this was the case all over the Don region. So the more people came into daily contact with the Reds, the more Cossacks and peasants, the more news flowed to everyone else about what these people really were. Again, they were much better at propaganda. And they had a certain believability. This nonsense about, the landlords and everything else. There were really no landlords in this area to begin with, and certainly not in West Siberia, which is a separate issue. But as this snowballs, these uprisings begin to grow. We're still in not even the spring, barely, of 1918. The local Soviets began to take extreme measures. Irritating the Cossacks was a big mistake, at least for a while. And even the Upper Don also began to revolt. Now we're getting closer to the center of Russia. And councils and Congress and conferences were continuously being called to mobilize whatever forces they could against the Reds. So April 1st, Novocherkassk was occupied by the Cossack forces, and that's when the Soviet forces fled to Rostov. Second Cossack Congress took place that very same day. This was the day, by the way, Kornilov was killed. So we're talking about two different movements here. The announced call to arms, the Congress elected an executive body, which became the Defense Council of the Don, which was a Cossack force. The Bolshevik raid from Rostov on Manichskaya, which is where this took place, by ship actually failed. But their attack on Novocherkassk caused the Cossacks to clear the capital of the Don and retreat to the village of Zepleskaya. That's where they began to organize their army, trying to attach this patchwork of resistance forces. Even within Cossack detachments, you have different agendas, and it's always very difficult. Referring to the volunteer army, Don, Kuban Cossacks, peasant unions, all with their own agenda, all with differing levels of militancy. But as 1918 continued, dragged on from the winter to the early spring, the anti-communist forces grew and grew and grew, and the Bolsheviks knew this. So the steppe detachment, General Popov, continued recruitment and training, and the Don was divided into districts. And given, especially high-ranking colonels, majors, lieutenant colonels, igniting an uprising wherever they go, telling them, using, actual peasants who experience what happened, this is what the Bolsheviks are, don't listen to their propaganda. So you had two Bolshevik centers by the middle of April, the northern, which was in Grushevsk, and in Novocherkassk in the south, roughly. On the left bank of the Don, between it and Rostov, there was also a Zadonsk group. and there was inaccurate information about either the German or Ukrainian forces towards them, either from the north from Voronezh or from the west from Bakhmut. And there was also accurate news about the approach of the volunteer army from the south, from the Kuban. And that encouraged the Cossacks near Donetsk. Despite the death of Kornilov, the reputation of the volunteer army preceded them wherever they went. So by the middle of April, the Germans had taken substantial chunks of this territory. They had taken, for example, the Cherkovil station, the southeastern railway, roughly 200 miles north of Novocherkassk. And that cut off from Voronezh, a group of Bolsheviks, and from Bakhmut to Milorov, against which the rebel Cossacks had decided to fight. So the Germans were splitting the Bolsheviks, causing them to panic, and of course used their continuous scorched earth tactics, which did nothing but increase the ranks of the volunteers in the Cossack forces. Again, we're coming to the end of the war as far as World War I is concerned, but two other German divisions moved from Bakhmut to the Don along the railway there, and then to the major city of Rostov. Rostov was and is a major city. And even a Romanian group, Colonel Drozdovsky, was coming from Romania and was in Mariupol on April 15th, who accidentally encountered some of these. So the rebel Cossacks had tremendous help. No one at this point thought that the Germans were pro-Bolshevik at all. What Berlin did up until this point, and what the infantry units in the south, parts of Ukraine coming from Romania, those were two different things. The Bolsheviks still held some of the cities, and yet it was the Cossacks and the volunteers that held much of the countryside. So Novocherkassk was retaken by Colonel Denisov, and at the end of April, Cossacks from the east and Germans from the west entered the major city of Rostov, where the Bolsheviks were defeated. And the defeat of the Bolsheviks at Taganrog and elsewhere led to their absolute panic. And that gave the volunteer army entering the Don region the freedom of movement, you know, and now that Denikin was finally given some breathing room. The president of the Don Soviet Republic was created, Potelkov, who had been caught and executed the day before, and that event, and he was tried, and his execution caused great celebration. These people were not, for the most part, native to these areas, and to the extent that they were not exactly your best citizens. So we're talking about a month-long struggle of, although the white side was very disjointed, you had a cleansing of this region, the Second Don District, and almost the entire first one, most of the Cherkasy and Upper Don districts, which is a very rich area, were freed. And the Germans ended up doing a lot of this work. So General Kornilov, let's get back here to at the end of his life, did show disappointment in the combat capability of the Cossacks at the time. He wanted to leave and go to the all-Russian front, the Volga and West Siberia. He didn't think that the Cossacks had the all-Russian idea in mind. He didn't like, despite his brilliance and so many other things, he saw the Don and the Kuban Cossack struggle as a local one, not a Russian one. They didn't have the same purpose, although they did have the same enemy. Despite the fact that the Cossacks had saved the volunteer army many times while Kornilov was alive, but what the Kornilov's great mission and why this ice march is of such extraordinary importance was preserving what would be the core of what he and Denikin thought was the future Russian army. He moved away from the railways because the Reds were operating the railways at the time. He saved the army for the future and created this myth, and myth not in the sense that it's false, but in the sense that it was very inspiring, of this ice march. And the Germans and the Cossacks gave him a certain freedom of action. Well, both Kornilov and Denikin. and the Cossacks were always, certain elements were vacillating only because they didn't want to be sucked into an all-Russia campaign when their concern was their own independence. Kornilov was drawn to Siberia, but the revival of the Don was also extremely important. But where, when you have limited forces, where are they going to be concentrated? And that was the big issue. In other words, getting involved in a fight for the Kuban after their march in the Don was to them a very risky idea. But it isn't to say that he was anti-Cossack. Of course not. But he created a myth that the Cossacks ended up being mobilized around for some time. So that is a very, very abbreviated and complex thumbnail sketch of what happened. We're talking about the first Kuban campaign, the first Kuban war, or the Ice March, lasted 80 days. 44 of these days were engaged in physically exhausting actual battle, shooting and being shot. The army in this process, which I only gave a very abbreviated conception, marched over 800 miles under the worst of conditions with all of these wounded. And despite heavy losses, 5,000 men returned home. They didn't start off with 5,000 men. They lost a lot of men, showing how popular they truly were and how they came from every possible background. They were not landowners. The officers were not landowners. The idiots still talk about the nobility landowners, like we're talking about pre-revolutionary France. It's not the case. The Ice March created the White Army. It became a baptism of fire for the whites. It became a sacred legend. In fact, they even created their own ribbon, a sword with a crown of thorns on the St. George ribbon. And, of course, you know, what makes things more complicated is that as the Ice March was going on, you had the other campaigns of white units, the Assi-Don campaign of Colonel Mikhail Drozdovsky, as I mentioned, and the Steppe campaign of the Don Cossacks. But what the Ice March in particular did was show that even despite being wildly outnumbered, victory was not only possible, but probable, so long as the enemy was these irregular red units. On occasion, I mean, this threatened the Reds to such an extent that they invented the legend of their Iron March from Luhansk to Taritsyn by train. But that's a dishonest parallel. The Reds traveled during the summer in comfort, armed to the teeth, and by rail. No one approached them. The common population wanted nothing to do with them. The whites under Kornilov, and then at the end, Denikin, walked hundreds of miles in the bitter cold, obtaining their weapons and food only as a result of battle, storming every village and not abandoning a single wounded man, at least under Kornilov. And you can't even say that Denikin abandoned anyone because he left doctors there at these villages. And that was only the worst of the worst who would have died if they were brought back on the trail. They came close to taking Ekaterindar, which was a major city for them, but their retreat was orderly despite the thousands of wounded that they had with them. The military skill that this handful of men showed was extraordinary. But it's true that the White Army didn't really have an idea, but this was as close, this was a martial symbolism rather than an ideology that inspired a lot of people later to join up, to save Russia from these atheists, these murderers, these materialists. Well, of course, it's a purely negative conception. It's easy to be against something, but there needs to be a positive program. And this wasn't fully understood, but the White Army, regardless of where they ended up, was the future of Russia. And the mission of the Russian immigration, which was a speech by Ivan Bunin, who I've quoted many times in this program, he said this. He said, "Even though the clothes of the white warrior were not always like mountain snow, may his memory be hallowed forever. For there is a tomb of Christ, Russia, and I will bow to her alone. On the day when the angel rolls away the stone from her tomb, let us wait for this day. Until then, let it be our mission not to give in to temptations or arguing or factionalism. This is deeply important, both in general for this unrighteous time and for the future righteous paths of Russia itself. On the 10th anniversary, February 22nd, 1928, Ivan Shmyhalev wrote in his Eternal Testament, talking about the Ice March in particular, he said, "A few volunteers, abandoned by everyone, exhausted by long battles, bad weather, frost, apparently exhausted their strength and ability to fight, went to the Kuban steppes, starting the ice campaign. Now 10 years later, the deepest meaning of this strange historical fact is revealed to us, and in this madness we begin to see the stunning greatness of our spirit. The spirit did not submit to matter. The incorruptible did not succumb to decay. A great mystery has played out on the icy steppes of the Kuban. It played out in the name of the eternal struggle of spirit over matter, light over darkness, good over evil, and life over death. Historically, the ice campaign narrows for us in time and meaning, but even on this scale, it remains great. All of Russia is, as of 1928, in the grip of evil, violence, and temptation. 150 million people, innumerable military reserves, all wealth, nature itself, all at the disposal of a merciless enemy. And so a handful of men, strong in spirit, mostly young men, led by worthy leaders, refused to bow down or spiritually give up. And so they went to the icy steppe, into the unknown, to continue to fight into the last breath for Russia, but not only for Russia, but also its spiritual and historical truth, the undying meaning of the great events of February 9, 22, 1918, the departure to the icy steppe, a meaning born from the immortal meaning of the Calvary sacrifice, akin to the most wonderful moments in the history of the human experience. The feat begun by this handful of men is the beginning of the Holy Revolution, a highly spiritual one against the red darkness. The ice campaign is one of the brightest in terms of spiritual life and one of the purest pages of Russian history. The ice march still continues here and there, and it continues in its purity." Thank you, everyone, for listening, and I'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.